Blog Talk Radio.
I be on it all night, man. I be on it all day. Straight up pimp. If you want me, you can find me in the air. I'm on it, 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 I'm on it. Time and time again, I gotta turn back round and tell these crows that I am the H and I can trick. That's just the way it goes. I be on that shit that I had you on that. I don't want no more. At this time, I need all my freak show to get down on the floor. If you came to rep your set, right that partner, let them know. Yeah, like it was stop when I headed to sleep, damn it, I go. I'll be out in the week, straight heat swerving down your street. In the stolen blind, the bill with 23s on the feet. The legend, Rocky D. Brown, back in time to be you down. Give me face, I love the sound. Slap the taste, they hit the ground. Back in the eight, click the
pick up, click the beat. I got no place on that. Another episode of Foul Territory here on Blog Talk Radio, coming to you live every single Wednesday, except the Wednesdays that it doesn't. Just kidding. Every single Wednesday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We're here on Blog Talk Radio. We're sponsored by backsportspage.com. Go check it out. But right now, you're here with me. You're here to discuss the baseball world, a little bit of football. There have been some developments. The combine occurred, which I'm sure all of you were intently watching as if every second of it was televised. But the real news is that the spring training games have started. It's not just pitchers throwing to catchers. It's not just guys stretching. It's not just guys limbering up. It's real baseball being played. And because MLB Network exists and because the media is, it's the unified universal theory of creep. If you read Tuesday Morning Quarterback, Greg Easterbrook on ESPN, it's this theory that everything keeps happening earlier and earlier. Cars that are the 2013 version go on sale in March of 2012. Christmas decorations go up right after Halloween ends, maybe even before Thanksgiving. It's this unified theory of creep. And likewise, in the baseball world, the media has stuck to the script. On the radio, on TV, all of these meaningless games. And frankly, I can't get enough. I sounded like I was going to be critical there for a second. You thought I was going to decry this ridiculous, ridiculous attention to detail, this broadcasting of meaningless baseball. But no, because to me, it's beautiful. And frankly, I'll just turn on one of those games. I don't care who it is. It's the seventh inning of the Detroit Tigers versus the Kansas City Royals. And there's not a guy playing in the game with a number lower than 55. I don't give a shit. I'll throw it on. I'll listen to it. Just the sound of baseball in the background makes me happy. It's this time of year. You can tell I'm excited. And so let's get right into one of our more playful segments. I'm going to be joined a little bit later on the show by Carson Phillips Spots, our expert NFL analyst. He's going to be calling in from the road to help us out with some combine commentary, as well as some of the reactions to the news around the NFL. But before we get into baseball, like I said, here is one of our more playful segments. That's Tweet Child of Mine.
She's got a smile that it seems to me reminds me of childhood memories. Where everything was as fresh as a bright blue sky.
All right, Tommy, you're the oldest. I'm counting on you. Come on.
She's got eyes of the bluest sky as if they thought of rain. I hate to look into those eyes.
Nice vibrato.
Not even an ounce of pain. But an ounce of pain we will be bringing later on in the show with our hard-hitting commentary. But first, I'm going to provide you with two tweets of the week because it's just me. And why would one be fun? One is always less fun than two if you watch those AT&T or Verizon commercials. See, the commercials aren't working because clearly they're not making me remember the product, just the annoying, overbearing, just hitting you over the head style. Anyway, my first tweet of the week was my own tweet, and I will give it to you right now. A girl physically in the peanut division steps automatically out of her class if she has the opalescent soul of a ministering angel. Yeah, that caught you off guard. You weren't ready for it. That's P.G. Wodehouse. Go look him up. One of the funniest writers of all time, satirizing the British leisure class. Go check it out. If you've ever heard of Jeeves.com, you owe that stupid domain name to Wodehouse. You owe almost every inside joke on the show Archer to Wodehouse, if you're a fan of that. So go check him out. That was just a little quotation from his book, Full Moon. The second tweet of the week comes to us from Mindy Kaling, the former star and writer of The Office. Well, not star, but supporting character and one of the head writers of The Office, now has her own show on Fox. Good for her. And this tweet was provided to us by Jane Claire Beale, Keeping It Beale, at Keeping It Beale. So go ahead and give her a follow. She provided us with this tweet, and it is from Mindy Kaling. Are you good at making breakfast sandwiches? If so, let's get married. Now, I cannot agree with Miss Kaling anymore. I never thought we'd be reading one of her tweets on this show, much less following it, having her tweet following a literary quotation. But when she talks that highly of sandwiches, especially breakfast sandwiches, there's no doubt that she's making on the show. So thank you, Mindy, for bringing this to our attention, so that I may in turn bring it to the attention of the listeners, and that is sandwiches, the art of the entire domain of the creation of their existence, my eating them, your eating them, our eating them. They're the best thing in the world, basically. In my opinion, the best food group. They span every culture, every cuisine has their own take on a sandwich. You can get very creative with sandwiches. It's one of my favorite things to make. So I just wanted to take a break out and talk about sandwiches for a minute here. Again, we're sponsored by Sandwiches. Sandwiches Incorporated brings you all the best sandwiches around the world. Sandwiches Incorporated. Let's get into the meat and potatoes, because after you have a sandwich, you have meat and potatoes, if you weren't already full enough. And we're going to continue with our fantasy baseball preview. I told you guys I would spread this out over a couple shows. I think it's better that way. We can get a little more in depth. We're not beholden to just big names. We can delve a little bit deeper into the sleepers and the buried old superstars, because there are a lot of them in baseball. Guys that were once at the top of their game managed to stick around by specializing in a certain skill in a way that an NFL player, for example, cannot do. Some NBA players are able to do that by kind of just, you know, that at one time they were a lead two guard and an all-around scorer. They kind of develop into a specialized three-point shooter. A lot of the same stuff happens in baseball with a guy who maybe was a middle-of-the-order bat at first base. Then he kind of, his star fades a little bit, but he's able to perfect that power stroke, maybe have a great platoon split so that he's valuable against righties or lefties, depending on what the case may be. And, you know, maybe he's a DH type first base guy to cover up. So just a little preview of some of the guys we might be getting to. And last week we did the National League East fantasy preview of the 2013 season. And today we're going to go over to the American League and keep it on the same latitude, or is it longitude? I can never remember. We're going to have to look that up with the Foul Territory Cracked investigating team on that. But we're getting to the American League, and the American League East has seen a bit of a shakeup. We're going to talk some over-under, some win totals, either later today or maybe next week, maybe a little bit as we get a little bit closer to the season and some things shake out in spring training, and we have the best idea of what the power balance might be. But this is an American League East. After the moves that the Blue Jays made in the huge trade they made with the Marlins, getting pretty much all the Marlins talent except for Giancarlo Stanton, making the trade with the Mets to bring R.A. Dickey on board, the 2012 National League Cy Young Award winner. A lot of people think that the Blue Jays might be the favorite to win that American League East. I'm going to say not so fast. I mean, to me, on paper, they do have the most talent, but the Rays always find a way to get there. The Orioles last year proved that they're for real, and I haven't even mentioned the two big money teams. But like I said, we're going to get a little bit more into the specific predictions for the year in terms of win totals probably next week. Today, we're going to focus a little more on the fantasy aspect of the American League East. Formerly the big money division in baseball, but there's a power shift going out west. But the East still has an incredible amount of talent, so we're going to start on the hill with starting pitchers. Their positional number is one for a reason. They are the single most important position on the diamond. Even though they pitch only once every 5 days, your starting pitcher has the biggest ability to affect the outcome of your team's games. And that's why we start with them. So we're going to start in the first tier of the American League East starting pitching. And we have three guys with pretty different stories. David Price, CC Sabathia, and R.A. Dickey. Now, it's easy to compare Price and Sabathia. They're big, powerful left-handers. And although they clearly have a different diet, they have a similar style of pitching. But Price is obviously still a very young guy. And a guy that, you know, maybe he hasn't even hit his ceiling yet. He came up with the Rays, was the first pick in the draft out of Vanderbilt University. Had that dominant stretch in his rookie season. And when he, in 2008, excuse me, when he pretty much acted as the exclusive closer for the Rays in the playoffs in their dominating run where they got oh so close to a World Series title, first World Series title. And he's just proceeded to improve pretty much year to year over his career. Last season, leading the American League in wins with 20, a 2.56 ERA, also led the American League. So two of the three Cy Young, or excuse me, Triple Crown categories, and obviously winning his first Cy Young of his career, which I think was very well deserved. He's only 27. He's hitting his prime, and this guy is scary good. Scary good. The Rays have an incredible defense behind him. He's got the strikeout pitch. The last few years, a strikeout-to-walk ratio of about 3.5 to 1, which is incredible. He's going to keep guys off base. He's going to be able to wipe guys out with his dominant stuff. He's going to give you over 200 innings. He has each of the last three seasons. You know, the only real question is, will he win enough games? You know, and that is to say, i.e., will the Rays score enough runs for him? He proved last year by winning 20-5. He only did it with two complete games and one shutout too. So the Rays are able to get him his runs. When they get him one or two, he is dominant. And so to me, he is far and away the top pitcher in this division. And I say that even with the incredible season that R.A. Dickey had. I still like Dickey. That's why I have him in this top tier. I think he is up there with Sabathia and Price in the conversation and in the top tier of pitchers that you would choose to pick in a fantasy draft, specifically because of his numbers. Now, on the Mets last year, he won 20 games, which is amazing because the Rays, a much better team than the Mets, that almost goes without saying, in 2012. He led the league in innings pitched, led it in complete games and shutouts and games started and strikeouts. He was the best pitcher in the National League, no questions asked. That's why he won the Cy Young, a 4.26 strikeout-to-walk ratio, 230 Ks. And, you know, only 54 walks for a knuckleballer is incredible. He's really smart. He's able to mix in his fastball when he needs to. And you got to think, he's only – well, it is tougher to pitch in the American League East versus the National League East. There is a just a level of difficulty factor there. Number one, the DH. Number two, the American League is just stronger. But there's also an inherent advantage into being the new guy in the division when you're a starting pitcher. Guys don't have a ton of experience against you. He's not a guy who has been dominant for a lot of years. He's not a guy that necessarily has been on the radar before now. Now he's a game that everybody circles, but, you know, the Red Sox lineup, the Yankees lineup, not having faced him before, maybe once or twice, and certainly not more than that within this dominant last year, a couple of years, that's a big factor for him. And he's able to just go out there and throw his stuff, and they have to prove they can hit it. And it's going to take them at least a couple starts to have any chance to settle in against Ari Dickey. Just an incredible story, and I don't see any reason he can't continue forward as a top-tier pitcher. I think the 2.7 ERA of last year is a little ambitious. I'd peg him at around 3, especially with the move and a little bit of regression. But I think 200-plus strikeouts should be easy for him if he can stay healthy, and he has been able to for a while now. So that's definitely a guy I look at, especially with that Toronto Blue Jays offense behind him. That's a guy I look at in the top tier. And for CeCe, the reason at the top of this I said that these guys are kind of going in different directions and that they're different stories is that CeCe, he has been one of the top tier pitchers in baseball for such a long time. It feels like it's been 20 years. He's been up forever. He came up as a young guy, so he has already a ton of wins, a ton of experience, even at an age that is not very old. And, you know, CeCe is a guy who has to bounce back a little bit from last year, to be frank. He was injured. That's true. He was injured. But he is a guy who he needs to lead the Yankee staff if they want to have a chance. And we're going to get later to some of their injuries and some things specifically in the Yankees outfield that may affect their chances in the division. But if they want to have any chance at all, be not wrong about this. CeCe is their most important guy. And while he had a very good year last year and did throw over 200 innings, even missing him for a couple starts was enough to maybe throw off their chances in division and could be going forward. He's a guy that arm has a ton of work. There's a huge workload that's been put on his arm, but there's no reason to think that he won't be able to keep it healthy for another year. But he threw exactly 200 innings last year. And I want to read you the inning totals from the 5 years before that because it's remarkable. It started 2011 and go back all the way to 2007. 237.1, 237.2, 230, 253, 241. I mean, that is horse status. So look at him to be right back up there. Again, the real question is staying healthy. And I think Josh Johnson is a guy who's knocking on the door of that top level. He's another guy who has had injury problems in his past, but last year was able to put those on hold and really plow through a full season with the Marlins. Now he goes to a much better environment with the Blue Jays team that believes it has a great chance of making the playoffs, making a run in the playoffs, and a team that is going to score runs for him. He never had that with the Marlins. His classic start with the Marlins would be 8 innings, 1 earned run, 3 hits, and 10 strikeouts, and he'd pick up a loss with a no decision. That's a classic Josh Johnson start from his whole career up until this point. But like I said with R.A. Dickey, the prospect of a very, very good Blue Jays offense only helps fantasy value because wins are one of the 5 categories, and that's a category that, the reason that it's a disputed stat, the reason that sabermetricians aren't a fan of the win is because it's one of those stats in pitching that the pitcher has the least control of any of them. The pitcher has very much control of whether he strikes someone out. The pitcher has a lot to do with whether a guy walks. But whether he gets a win is much more out of his hands, and a lot of it lies in the hands of his teammates, specifically with their bats. So I would be excited for Josh Johnson. Honestly, he's a guy who I would love to have in fantasy this year. If he can build on that healthy year last year, I mean, this Blue Jays rotation is just dirty. And again, great on paper, no guarantees in the division. We have an interesting next tier. That's John Lester, Brandon Morrow, Matt Moore. John Lester is a guy that needs to reinvent himself a little bit. He really looked like he was going to be one of the premier pitchers in this division a couple years ago, but has really hit some snags through 200 innings last year, but a 4.8 ERA. I just don't think he's that guy that's going to be striking out 9 and 10 people for 9 innings. And if he doesn't do that, it's going to be a struggle, and he's going to be probably a guy who throws it with an ERA in the mid-3s. But even that is very good, and I think he'll stabilize himself a little bit this year. But I really don't know. I really don't know with Lester, and I'm not eager to jump on that train. I'm definitely not someone who's going to be taking a chance on him this year in fantasy. Brandon Morrow, though, I will be taking a chance on. Got him last year. Had kind of a mini breakout year. Didn't really do all the things that people were thinking he would do. But in terms of the actual results, I think he could not have been happier. Specifically talking about that 2.96 ERA. Didn't strike out as many people as he had in the past. Kind of worked on getting contact outs. Worked on not having to throw a ton of innings. But he has to build that arm strength back up if he's going to be any sort of major contributor in fantasy. And Matt Moore, I just love going forward. I had a little bit of a disappointing year in terms of where his hype was at before last year. But really, I think still just as promising, and was only a number 3 prospect in a year when Mike Trout and Bryce Harper were far and away the best best-looking young major leaguers, or soon-to-be major leaguers in the whole entire universe, in the Milky Way galaxy and galaxies beyond. Clay Buchholz is another guy who I'm not going to take a flyer on. Another one of these Red Sox pitchers. He had one really dominant year, an ERA, I think it was around 2.3, but another guy that sabermetricians do not look at and say he's a guy who can sustain that. The Red Sox don't need him to be great. They just need him to be solid. They need a lot of bounce back from that rotation, and I think they're banking on that based on what they did. And another guy who's brought in there to stabilize it is Ryan Dempster. A guy who, in retrospect, if you listen to Foul Territory or catch up on any of the archived episodes, we were all a little relieved when he didn't get traded to the Braves. I think we were a little peeved at the beginning when he didn't want to come to the Braves, but that's a different issue. And a guy that wasn't able to help Texas down the stretch enough as they ceded the division to the A's in the last week and obviously went out in the wild card game, to the Baltimore Orioles. So in the same boat as the Braves were, which I think it's hard to even argue that you make the playoffs if you lose in the play-in game. I don't think it should count as a playoff team. But the young guns are what are exciting to me. And on Tampa Bay, we're talking about Hellboy Jeremy Hellickson and Alex Cobb, who also got his feet wet last year. And, you know, last week or the week before, we talked about the James Shields Wade Davis trade, with the Rays sending two of their more experienced guys, and in Shields, one of their best pitchers, without question, one of the best pitchers in probably the whole American League the last few years, sending them out. And a big reason is because they have confidence in their youngsters, and they always have a lot of turnover. They're always having to get rid of veterans who get to a point where financially they're unable to keep them around. And in order to survive as a franchise, they always have to have talent coming down the pipeline. And that doesn't just mean having a strong farm system. It means having a consistently producing farm system. It's easy, like the Royals the last few years, to have this stockpile of talent and dream about it. But you also have to have a stockpile of talent that's realistic and that is going to come through for you. And that's not just a guy who's kind of a roll of the dice guy, a guy who has a high ceiling who you're thinking, well, he could be great or he could be nothing. The Rays have some of those, but you also have to flood that system with guys who you know, okay, this guy has a very good chance to get to the majors. He may not be dominant, but he's going to at least be solid for us. They need every level of prospect. They need guys plugging in holes. They need guys jumping into starting roles. They need guys, you know, just as bit players or whatever the case may be. And they seem to do it every year, which is why, and they're the main reason I'm hesitant to hand this division to the Blue Jays. They really are going to make it tough on them. And Alex Cobb is going to need to be a big part of that. Went 11-9 last year in 23 starts, 136 innings, and pretty good year, really, all around. Struck out only 7 guys per 9. You think that would go up after he was able to strike out 9.5 guys in AAA last year, and then 9.4 guys per nine in 2011. You know, you expect that to go down a little bit, but if you can get it up near 8 or so, that should be a way for him to have a ton of success. Posted a 58.8 ground ball percentage, which, I'm not mistaken, that's a pretty good number, and also a very high amount of his fly balls going for home runs. So maybe got a little unlucky in producing his 4.03 ERA, but I think definitely a promising rookie campaign and a guy who the Rays are going to ask to solidify the middle of that rotation, again, with the departure of Shields and Wade Davis, although Davis wasn't even starting. You know, he was long relief, much to his chagrin. So let's talk about the sleepers in this division, and sticking with the Rays theme, because why not? We're going to talk about Chris Archer a little bit. And Chris Archer is a guy who just had a little cup of coffee last year, 29 innings pitched, some time out of the bullpen, but also he got 4 starts and, you know, struck out a lot of guys, got banged around a little bit, exactly what you would expect. But this is a guy who came over from the Cubs, and his time in the Rays minor league system was very up and down. You know, jumped right into Double A and got banged around at the tune of a 4.42 ERA. Really has struggled with a ton of walks throughout his career. And he's going to really need to locate the ball, have better command, especially of his fastball, in order to succeed. And he's got a very good chance to make the starting rotation. I think he's in a battle with for the number 5 spot in that rotation. And so a very good chance he could win that starting spot, especially depending on how he does in spring training. So, you know, a guy that, while he may not put up great numbers, it's always valuable to have a guy who's going to start all year, assuming he stays afloat and stays healthy. So I could be excited about Chris Archer. You know, he's a guy definitely to watch in spring. He's a guy whose spring is really important for some established players and stars. It doesn't make a difference at all. They're just going through the motions. And while it's necessary for them to make that preparation to get themselves ready for the season, personally, it's much more important for guys who are trying to prove themselves to the team and not only build their own confidence, but build the organization's confidence in them. So Chris Archer, ladies and gentlemen, look for him to crack that Rays starting rotation sometime soon. A couple guys for the Orioles, who are exciting me. I'm sure you know who Dylan Bundy is. If you don't, we touched on him last week. He is the Orioles' phenom starter. He just absolutely torched the minor league last year, made it all the way up to Double A. And, you know, he is a big, big body. He is a big guy with a big fastball and super young. So I would imagine that the Orioles are going to really have the kid gloves on a little bit. He's only 19. He doesn't turn 20 till the end of September. I mean, good Lord, the 4th pick of the 2011 amateur draft, obviously out of high school if he's only 19. But he even got in one major league game last year. So, you know, he's a guy who I'm not really sure how soon the Orioles, why do I keep saying Royals, would bring him up. I'm not sure what they would be willing to do, but, you know, he's a guy, if you're in a really deep league, maybe stash him on your bench, because if he can come up and dominate, have a run, maybe if he comes up in the second half, or if he's again tearing up the minors and they suffer an injury, you know, he might be a guy who gets called up earlier. Might be a guy who gets called up to stand in for Chris Tillman or someone else if they're struggling. So Dylan Bundy, I mean, just be thrilled for him. And if you're in a dynasty league and you have him stashed away in your minor leagues, you should be grinning a big old grin, as the Orioles front office is when they snag Dylan Bundy. Let's take a look at that draft. I'm curious who actually went ahead of Bundy. So this was a pitching-heavy draft, as many are, really. And it went Garrett Cole to the Pirates, obviously a UCLA starter who is considered a potential future number one, a guy who the Pirates will probably see up in the majors a little bit this year. Danny Holson to the Mariners out of UVA, a guy who might get some PT again this year. So really this draft might be breaking through. Trevor Bauer is a guy who got some pitching experience up at the big league club with the Diamondbacks last year before getting dealt to the Indians in the offseason. And then Bundy was picked fourth. So a very promising top four picks in terms of starting pitching there in that 2011 amateur draft. But yeah, I think that about ties up our starting pitchers. And so let's get to the relief pitchers real quick. In this American League East, even though he's coming off a devastating injury, even though he's God knows how old, probably 45, I still think Mariano Rivera has the crown of best American League East relief pitcher. And until he comes out and can't throw again or has another injury, you know, I'm not going to take that crown away from him. He is simply dominant, the best relief pitcher of all time, one of the best pitchers of all time, really. And I have every reason to expect he'll be back and he will be able to just dominate the end of games for the Yankees. And while the Yankees probably aren't going to win 100 games this year, maybe not even 90, he's a guy who he'll get the saves when he gets the chances. So in fantasy, always good to have Mariano, always racks up the strikeouts. And even a small step back would still place him in the top five easily of closers in the big leagues just based on his consistency. Fernando Rodney, I just don't know. I just don't know. Nobody saw coming how good he would be for the Rays as their closer. I kind of have an irrational trust in the Rays front office and the Rays management. And when they find a guy who really produces, I'm almost more inclined to trust them than I would most teams. You know, some other teams I might say, oh, well, they got lucky. This guy wasn't really great. They just got a good season out of him and don't give the management too much credit. But you know, a guy who pitched for the Tigers for a lot of years, broke in with the Tigers and then spent some time with the Angels. Last year for the Rays, just completely dominated the ninth inning with a 0.60 ERA. That's right, you heard it, a 0.60 ERA. Just a dominant performance. 48 saves, he threw 74 innings, managed to strike out 76 guys, only allowing 15 walks. Five earned runs all year. Five earned runs. So that is good enough. I mean, that is good enough where he, to me, should be the unquestioned number two relief pitcher in this division. Regression is going to happen, basically. If you have a 0.6 ERA over the course of a year, even as a reliever, regression is definitely going to happen. But even if he regresses a full run or a full 2 runs to, you know, a 1.5 to 2 ERA, he will still be one of the best relief pitchers in all this division for fantasy purposes. And, I expect him to continue his success, if not at the level of last year. David Robertson is an interesting case, has been setting up for the Yankees for a while, got a few chances to close, has dominant, nasty stuff. And I like him, even though he doesn't have the closer's job. In the event that Rivera is hurt or, you know, his injury is re-aggravated, Robertson is a clear choice. So he's kind of got that potentially in the bag as, you know, he's a number one in a backup plan, which when you're planning for relievers, that's actually not a bad place to be. People like me who picked up Kenley Jansen last year found that out as well. If you are a dominant reliever and, you know, even if there's a very good closer ahead of you, if you're the clear number two guy, that's still a valuable place to be, especially when it's a guy like Rivera who's so old and, you know, is having to come back from a devastating injury. So even if Robertson isn't closing, he could still snake you some wins. If you're going to hold the lead, then he's very valuable. This guy strikes out an incredible amount of people. That kind of funky sidearm-ish action, not completely sidearm, but screw arm action. And this guy was a great find for the Yankees. Joel Hanrahan and Jim Johnson, I kind of have similar levels of confidence in. I mean, Johnson is a guy who walks about 4 or 5 people per 9 innings and manages to escape unscathed many times and just had over 50 saves for the Orioles last year. And you know, but as one of those guys who a lot of people predict will implode at a certain point. And I don't think that's completely unfounded, but for fantasy purposes, a guy who has at least a fairly strong hold on the closer's role is valuable. And if he plays for a good team and has a pretty good hold on the closer's role, and he's at least a solid pitcher and has some sort of track record, he's valuable. So Johnson, I'd put slightly ahead of Hanrahan. Hanrahan is probably going to be closing for the Red Sox, although they won't be a great team. You know, he's had success before with the P-Rats, the Pirates, and Andrew Bailey, you know, has a chance to close at a certain point during the year if Hanrahan's not cutting it. The Blue Jays situation is real interesting. Sergio Santos is the guy they pegged as their closer going into last year and started off the season hot, but only threw a few innings before he went down for the whole year, pretty much, I think, if I remember correctly. And so Santos is a guy with something to prove. Casey Jansen stepped in Santos' absence, although I hope he's abstinent as well. Casey Jansen stepped in the absence of Sergio Santos, and he just pitched really well. So you got to think that he has the edge coming into the season on that closer role because he got it done. And a lot of the time, managers, when it comes to the closer role, are very hesitant to put a new guy in and will always appreciate the track record. And now that Sergio Santos is completely new blood, but you got to think, barring some kind of implosion in spring training, Casey Jansen has the inside track on that closer role for the newly souped up Canadian Blue Jays. So that's the relief pitchers. That's all the time I want to spend on them. They're not as exciting, but you got a lot of solid options here in the American League East. A lot of guys kind of on that questionable second tier. You're not sure if they're going to be closing, but still attractive pieces who you could be able to pick up very late in the draft or just kind of sign as a $1 or $2 flyer. And you know, guys to get excited about. So let's get to the offensive side of the ball. Because for a while, this division has been known as the power division. And while its star has faded a little bit with respect to the other divisions in baseball, especially the American League West, and even the National League West in some ways, there's still a lot of offensive talent in this division. So we're going to get right to it, starting with the catchers. And this is a particularly weak position throughout the majors on offense, that is for fantasy purposes. No defensive stats go into fantasy, unfortunately. Maybe you have a league where you count catchers' caught stealing percentage. That would be pretty cool. I've never seen that, but we're going to stick to the offensive numbers. Although defense can be important in this way in fantasy, you have to play good enough defense to be in the game. And so if you're not playing good enough defense to be in the game, you have no fantasy value. So in that respect, fantasy does rely on defense in kind of a weird kind of backwards way. But Matt Wieters out of Georgia Tech, switch hitting catcher for the Baltimore Orioles, is clearly the top dog in this division at the catcher position. Had long been hailed as kind of the next superstar, the savior, if you will, of the Baltimore Orioles. And it's taken a little while because people are impatient, but he's slowly figuring that out and living up to it. Had a very good season last year. The batting average isn't great, but at the catcher position, that's no surprise. There's very few batting average studs at the catcher position. Obviously a guy like Posey or Joe Mauer being the exception to the rule. But he has displayed the power that everybody thought would come. 23 home runs last year, 22 the year before. There's no reason to think that won't go up from there, even as he continues to play more and more games. 144 last year, which is his career high. You expect a catcher to stabilize around there, not play too many more. But he's a guy, you know, obviously in the American League who can get some reps at designated hitter, which only helps his ability to be a good fantasy player and to stay relevant and stay in that lineup. Only 67 runs, but 83 RBIs, a very strong showing at the catcher position. So no reason to expect much of a dip in those numbers whatsoever. And the batting average, while it's not pretty at 250, based on Weider's talent level, I think there's a good chance that that only has a chance to go up as well. Has posted really low BABIPs the last 2 years, 276 in 2011, 274 last year. Even for a slow catcher, that's a pretty horrendous batting average on balls in play. So if that goes up, don't be surprised to see that average climb back up into the at least the 260s as a result. And that overall line looks much better if he can get to about 25 home runs, stay in the 80s in RBIs, and get that average up closer to 260, maybe even 270. Definitely looks like a very attractive option at catcher. Although if you're doing a snake draft, you might want to stay away from getting a catcher in the middle rounds, because a guy like Weider's, he could just go high based on positional scarcity, and you could see him going way too high. And in that case, while I like him as a talent, you gotta think about what makes sense for you in the draft, and don't always follow those runs. When everybody starts taking catchers, and everybody just took five, or you know, five people before you just took a catcher, it's time to look somewhere else, because the value has gone down. And the good news is nobody will be picking one for a while, and you can kind of scoop up some of the sleepers. It starts to get ugly after this. We have two high-powered potential guys with Jared Saltalamacchia, the longest last name in baseball history, and J.P. Arencibia for the Blue Jays, who hung on to his starting role pretty much because Travis d'Arnaud went over to the Mets in the R.A. Dickey trade. Arencibia and Saltalamacchia, both with a healthy amount of power, guys who should easily hit 20 home runs if they get enough PT, but guys who are going to be batting average drains. So the catcher position, you kind of have to think about whether that's worth it. If you have enough high average guys, and it doesn't matter, you know, to have a really, really bad average guy, maybe go after Arencibia. I mean, if Weider's is at 260, 270, you know, that might be a low average overall for a fantasy player, but for a catcher, that's high. Arencibia, we're talking more in the 230, 240 range. So that can be hard to stomach, even if you are picking up those power numbers, those home runs, and a decent amount of RBIs low down in that lineup as well. You got to really consider that when thinking about these kind of players. David Ross is the backup for the Boston Red Sox, and I'm pretty upset that the Braves weren't able to hang on to him. And while he's not a great fantasy option, I still would consider him. And this is why. Jared Saltalamacchia, while he put up decent offensive numbers last year, he just doesn't have the ability to catch a game that David Ross does, the ability to call a game, the ability defensively and with his throwing arm behind the plate. And this is where I was talking about the defensive side of the game mattering in fantasy. If the Red Sox feel that Ross gives them a better chance to win because of his all-around game, you could see him getting many more bats than he used to get on the Braves, who had Brian McCann entrenched at the catcher position. You could see him getting, you know, who knows, 300, 400 at bats. It's not likely, but I think it's possible. And in that event, I could see him putting up very good numbers, especially playing his home games at Fenway Park. I mean, 400 at bats of David Ross, I'll take that in my catcher position. I would take that over 600 at bats of Arencibia, because I think if Ross had that many at bats, he would put up at least solid power numbers. The average wouldn't be horrible, and he's just a consistent guy. Then I don't even want to get into Jose Molina and Francisco Cervelli. If you are drafting those guys, or if you're worrying about that on your team, you're in a very deep league, and you probably don't need my advice. But my advice, if you are not in a super deep league, is stay the hell away from Yankees catching and Rays catching. Unless Austin Romine has a chance and gets called up by the Yankees. Who knows? Well, I've been talking for 45 minutes now, and it's fun. But why don't you guys say something back? Answer me back on Twitter at Asa Base on Balls. That's ASABASEONBALLS at Asa Base on Balls. Get to me there on Twitter. Get to Carson at CSpots, SEESPOTTS on Twitter. Tweet at the show at foul_territory. That's foul, not like the bird, FOUL. Or tweet at Back Sports Page, backsportspage.com. your best place for hard-hitting analysis, exclusive interviews, and all these great podcasts, including our own Foul Territory. So go check out backsportspage.com. I also want to give a little plug for Sidelines. Sidelines is the most fun place to go on the web to debate about your favorite teams, your favorite players, and all the latest stuff going on in sports. Sidelinesapp.com, sidelinesapp.com, and you can tweet at them at sidelinesapp. You can also just go to Facebook and search for Sidelines. You can get connected through there and get on there, talk to your friends about sports, talk to fellow fans about sports, and let your thoughts be known. And the greatest thing about it, I haven't even mentioned yet, saving it for the end, the juicy details, is that there are lots of chances to win all sorts of swag. I'm talking about the latest Madden, the latest FIFA, the latest NBA, NBA 2K13, whatever you want. We're talking about gift cards, Amazon.com, Best Buy, all sorts of stuff is available, pro jerseys at Sidelines app. We have contests all the time. You just need to come on over to Sidelines, get involved in one of those contests, and who knows, your comment could be selected and you could win one of these great prizes. So go check out sidelinesapp.com tonight, today, tomorrow, sometime soon. Get on there. Waste no time. So I had to give that word to our sponsors, and we will continue with our fantasy preview of the American League East, talking about the offensive players, the hitters in that division. We already covered the starting pitchers, the relief pitchers, and the catchers. And now we get to the guys out on the diamond. And we will start with first base because we're going pretty much in the order of positional numbers. One pitcher, two catcher, three first, etc. And first base is a pretty powerful position in this division. No surprises there. Gone is Adrian Gonzalez, a guy who everybody thought would be a fixture in this division for years to come. Obviously part of that Red Sox fire sale. But the Red Sox brought in Mike Napoli. So where does Mike Napoli stack up among the first basemen in the American League East? And a lot of these guys overlap at the DH position, but it's key to at least have enough at-bats where you're qualifying at first and not just a DH. So, you know, a guy who's only a DH, you got to play him at that utility position. And just like on a major league team, it limits your flexibility. So what have you done for me lately? Everybody says is the NFL's slogan, but for my fantasy preview, at least, I do consider the last few years, up to the last 5 years, and a guy's overall track record. But it's hard to dispute when someone has a breakout season and someone dominates the year before. I think it colors everybody's view of the person a little bit. I think last year's numbers have undue influence on fantasy. And, you know, I don't want to commit to that. I'm not someone who's going to knee jerk, but certain guys have showed me things that just make me trust that this improvement is for real. And the guy that I'm leading up to, they call him E5, EE, whatever you want to say. But he's my best American League first baseman, and that's Edwin Encarnacion, a guy who spent some time with the Reds, had one 20 plus homer season with the Reds, but overall a bit of a disappointment, not what they thought he would pan out to be. Comes over to the Blue Jays and has really reinvented himself in that park. And last year just stepped up and was a masher, especially in the absence of Jose Bautista, Joey Bats, who dealt with injuries pretty much throughout the year. Edwin Encarnacion was the strength of that lineup. He was the consistent force in the middle, popping it out, driving in runs. His triple crown stats are a thing of beauty. 42 bombs, 110 ribbies, and a 280 average. That's just superb. If you're in a league that deals with OPS, he was almost better. He was definitely better. This is a guy who had a 941 OPS last year, and that is very sexy. A lot of that fueled by that 384 on base percentage. He was taking his walks. He was selective. He knew exactly what he was doing. And even with a 266 BABIP, he managed a 280 average. So that spike in walks up from 8.1% of his at-bats being walks to 13% is a lot of what drove that value. And, you know, it's a kind of a chicken and egg scenario. You say, well, was it that he had great power numbers and so pitchers were more careful and that's why he got more walks? Or did he become selective, only swinging at better pitches, and that was why he was able to have good power numbers? So it's hard to say. I didn't watch the Blue Jays enough to know exactly what was the chicken and what was the egg in that scenario. But I trust in Edwin. I really do. I don't know if 40 home runs is reasonable to expect again, but I definitely think mid to high 30s is reasonable. And, you know, almost scored 100 runs in the middle of that order, even threw in 13 stolen bases. This dude's a fantasy stud, and it only helped that that lineup got better. It only helped. He's probably the four hitter. They still probably put Bautista three. But adding Jose Reyes to the top of that order, adding some more thump, and just really having it more balanced. You got good bats behind Encarnacion. Lind maybe has a bounce back year. Rasmus, who knows, you know, still a guy with some potential to really develop a above average offensive game. But look for EE to get a ton of RBI chances. And he can play almost every day because he gets a lot of time at DH. So for fantasy, this is your guy. I think he's really exciting from a fantasy perspective. It looks like we have Carson Phillips spots. I'm going to bring him on. Carson. Carson, are you there, my friend?
Hello?
Hey, buddy. Sorry you were on hold there.
What's going on? You hear me?
I can hear you, yeah.
How's everything?
It's great, man. It's great. What's going on with you? Ladies and gentlemen, Carson Phillips spots. I can hear the applause from here. What's going on with you?
Not too much, man. Just happy to grab the last bit of the show here. You know, I didn't want to interrupt. I heard you know doing your in-depth preview of the American League. It was definitely intrigued. I was here taking notes, you know, logging stuff into my Excel spreadsheet. So, you know, everything's going well, man. Another week in Atlanta wrapping up, coming to a close. You know, everything's good. Combine was this past week, but, you know, I'll touch on that a little bit later. But everything's well, man. Can't complain.
Good. Well, let's just continue quickly through this American League East a little bit more.
Let's do it.
With the first baseman, there's not a ton to talk about at all these positions, so maybe we'll be a little selective. I definitely want to talk about the outfielders and second base. But yeah, maybe third as well. We'll continue with this, and then we will get to some of the combine stuff. It's also some breaking news in the NFL from a player personnel standpoint, so that's going to be fun to talk about too. So like I was saying, E5, get him on your team. Mark Teixeira, there's a question mark. That really is a question mark there. A guy who struggled mentally last year, kept changing his approach, was trying to go opposite field, then was like, no, I'm a pull hitter. I don't know. If I'm the Yankees, I'm a little scared. And while that contract could never be as bad as the A-Rod one, I think it might end up being a pretty poor investment as well. Although, good defense from Tex. Second base is a fun one, and this is where – you know, they say good teams are built strong up the middle. And second base, as Carson knows, is one of our Major League Baseball skill positions. And
it's a skill position. You can't doubt that.
Definitely is. And very few guys highlight the skill position nature of second base more than Robbie Cano. And dude is just a smooth operator on the field. He's in his walk year. He's already a thug. The Yankees are going to need him, especially with Granderson going down. He's going to be the man in the middle of that order. He really has been for a couple of years, even granted all those home runs. Ever since A-Rod's decline, Cano has stepped up. And I don't know, to me, he might even be like a top five pick in a fantasy draft, in a snake draft, because second base isn't super deep. And he's a producer, and if you can add him, that would just be for me in the first round, pretty much anywhere after those top few guys, Robbie Cano. So I don't know, Carson. Do you think Detroit chance to be better, because he has been in years past. Pedroia did win his MVP. He has had better years than Cano. It's kind of gone back and forth. Do you think Pedroia has a chance to be better than Cano this year?
I don't know. I mean, in AC, you make a good point when you talk about Granison going down, sort of having that protection in the lineup for Cano, a guy who has pretty surprising power. For a guy who plays in the infield, he's not the biggest guy on the planet, but I think that Granderson going down does hurt him a little bit. But also with Pedroia, I think just Cano has been more consistent over the past couple of years, and so I sort of expect that to continue, whereas Pedroia has had up and down issues with injuries and consistency a little bit. So if I had to take my pick with those two guys, I'd probably go with Robbie Cano.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. And PD is that's a really solid fantasy player too, but I'm not sure if I like the draw as I liked him the last few years. He's a guy who's fantasy draft. He'll go one of the first few picks of the second round a lot of the time. That's paid off, but he might be their outfielder this year, or maybe Will Myers is getting called up. But I just put him here because, he has more value at second base. And with the average overall, but definitely has emerging power. I think it'll sustain that power, especially now that he's definitely getting 600 at-bats if he stays healthy. I mean, he's just too valuable to that team. And, they've had some talent apart. But, like Gloria, wait rounds it up to Zobrist. Heck. Although maybe Zobrist will be getting bounced up this year. Mycer Touris is a guy who I think is going to be starting for the Blue Jays, but I would be a little wary of him. He's going to lose some playing time to Emilio Blur from Miami. So his Touris just doesn't have the upside. He would hit 300, which is like where you get all the value, but he's still maybe he hits 300 and gets to the second spot of the order. Then he's valuable, but I'm not sure he's a guy I would target unless you're getting him really late and you it's the pickings are slim. But
yeah,
second can be pretty. What about Eva Longoria's brother, Evan Longoria? Is he going to be healthy?
Yeah, Evan. I had the option of picking young Evan last year as a keeper when I took over the team that was in shambles. I took to the championship game. Decided not to. Lost. I did lose, but I was ultimately happy with the decision I made not to pick him. I'm not really sure what the identity of that. That Rays team is sort of looking like right now. This is the fact that, they went through those changes in the offseason last year. Up and coming to us, obviously. So it's going to be interesting to see how that happens. I know Evan Longoria did end up making his spring training debut about a day ago. Got some action. So I'm not someone that would put a whole lot of value in him in terms of picking someone early. But that's just my opinion. I finished second in the league last year. Do with it what you please.
Yeah. I feel that. And you know what? He has never been healthy. He's very, very injury prone, and he's definitely talented. But a lot of his value on the diamond does come from defense. He's never had a particularly high average. So as a fantasy player, he's, even if he's healthy and at the top of his game, he's good, not great. I think is a fair analysis. Manny Machado's guy I would look at. Got his feet wet, a little cup of coffee last year with the Orioles down the stretch. I actually probably played close to half the season now that I think about it in a reserve role. But Machado should be getting the first crack at the third base job with J.J. Hardy and Trent shortstop. And this dude, he is an athlete. He is a smooth operator. And he is the guy who makes third base into a skill position. It's not always.
it's that one exception, you know, when that happens, when the third baseman becomes a skill guy. Love to see it.
Yeah, it's kind of like you got two tight ends on the field or something, you know?
That's it.
Well, let's get on to one of the more preeminent skill positions, and that's shortstop. And the American League shortstop scene is Jose Reyes and a bunch of dudes. And it's been a while since people put Derek Jeter into the category with a bunch of dudes, but I think at this point in his career, he is. J.J. Hardy as well. I don't know. You can draft him. I just don't believe. I think the power – oh, Kevin Durant had another triple-double. Sorry about that. The power is legit, but – oh, my God, Steph Curry. But it's not – I just don't trust it as being consistent power. I don't know. I don't trust him as a 30-home run hitter. Maybe not even 25, but, you know, a guy to keep your eye on. And now, UNL Escobar is pretty much, I think, slotted to be the Rays' opening day shortstop. But if he doesn't pan out, and he has proved that he's very good at not panning out in different situations, the Reds have a guy in the minors named Hak-Ju Lee. I believe they acquired him in Matt Garza trade with the Cubs. And he is a really talented young shortstop, a young Asian man, as you might guess from his rather ninja-like name. And he's a talented guy. So if Paul pisses that clubhouse off, if he can't fit in there and, you know, they ship him out, look for Hak-Ju Lee to get on at shortstop, bringing a little bit of the Eastern flavor to the skill position.
Yeah, it should be an interesting lineup. And so what do you project Jose Reyes playing out? I'm guessing at that second base position for the Jays. If you said UNL is going to be the opening day shortstop.
He's on the Rays now. Did I say Jays? I'm sorry about
that.
Oh,
no. Oh, excuse me. Okay. Well, say what?
Yeah, he's actually moved to the Rays. So.
Okay. You said Jays. That makes a lot more sense.
But didn't Blue Jays thought they were getting a steal when they traded for him with us, but it turns out, you know, they thought they could make him fit in, but he couldn't. So how many chances does the guy get? It's maybe the next question, you know? How many clubhouses can you kind of get essentially evicted from and have
definitely.
People he's a very talented guy, you know. He can play defense with anybody in the majors at short. I really believe that. But he's a head case at this point.
He is. I mean, he, like you said, the issues last year with the homophobic slurs written on his face, and, you know, in Atlanta, issues about his effort and you know, his willingness to sort of give, you know, 100% the entire time, just sort of wrote his ticket out. So he's back in, you know, South Florida or closer. Maybe more Cubans will help him out, you know?
Yeah, maybe that. Maybe that or the 7,000 people showing up for the Rays game won't really inspire him either. I can't blame him. Let's get to the outfield, though. And this division, it lost a couple prominent outfielders. Nick Swisher went to the Indians, B.J. Upton to the Braves. But it's still loaded from a talent standpoint in the outfield, especially with fantasy prospects, fantasy guys. And the breaking news is, of course, that Curtis Granderson broke his arm, his forearm, I believe.
It's breaking news, literally.
Yeah, it is. News just broke off Curtis Granderson. Sorry, Curtis. But he's weak now, which only comes out to about 5 weeks into the season, so maybe six. So he should be coming back early to mid-May. But who knows?
Did you have any background on his backup, Mesa?
I'm sorry? You said
is Curtis Granderson's backup, Mesa, I believe his last name, M-E-Z-A. Have you heard of him at all?
I don't believe I have. I feel...
No, I saw like a blurb about him on Sports Center the other day. I think he was picked up in 2003. So I don't know if you had any insight on that. But, I mean, like you said, you know, he's unknown. I thought that was pretty odd that he... No, I'd never heard of his name before, and he'd been an assistant on the team for you know, close to 10 years. So that was kind of odd, and, you know.
You know, he's had a early career. That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
A couple seasons, he had 20 home runs 1 year in A-ball, then 19 the next year, and then, you know, even had 14 home runs last year in Double A and 9 in Triple A, so 23 total last year.
Wow.
So I guess it makes sense, and I'm not sure if he's going to play center, if he is, or throw play some. Knows. But this does a lot. Simpson is a guy went from being sexy, dope hitter, Tigers, just a bomb. Bombers, and I think one of the guys took advantage of that right field wind tunnel and just his reference of a young Carson Phillips spot. But it's going to be tough, and I think breaking an arm, while that's bad, I think generally in baseball, at least, a bone injury is easier to come back from like a muscle injury. Tell me if that makes sense to you. I think it's just...
I mean, No, I think that definitely makes sense, especially, you know, I spoke about this a little while ago, I think just talking, just in conversation about how baseball guys really don't get sort of the same accolades in terms of being athletes, but when you look at an outfielder especially, or, you know, when you're skill guys, when you pretty much go from a position of standing rest to going full speed, you know, at the drop of the hat, I feel like that. Like you said, the ligaments and the tendons and the muscles get to be, you know, very important. So, like you said, I think that, you know, I agree with that analysis, that probably a little easier, I guess, if anything, to come back from a bone injury than a muscle or a ligament injury.
Yeah, and if it was going to be longer, especially with the Yankees, everyone would expect them to go out and make a move. But the kind of limited extent in terms of time of this injury, well, you know, this is still very important. Those games in April are just, you know, like much towards the standings as the one in September. But that coupled with the fact that the Yankees have actively been trying to cut payroll and get under the luxury threshold, I think they're not going to go make a move. And so that's why this guy, Melky Mesa. Some run, you know, and for a club like the Yankees, who also have just a nasty situation at catcher, and you're not used to seeing them let the position just really fester and ooze. But that's kind of, maybe Melky can stabilize that outfield a little bit. Who knows? Because they got Brett Gardner coming back. They got him coming back.
That's true.
But the top tier of the outfielders is Jose Bautista. And I'm tempted to put Adam Jones. You know what? It's Jose Bautista and Adam Jones. I think they're in the same class.
Wow.
He has the ability to just crush for power. And I don't know. I think 54 home runs is not going to happen again. I think he should get to the 40s pretty easily as long as he can stay healthy. But he really wasn't healthy last year and had problems even getting back. So while an offseason should be enough, that coupled with Adam Dunn's kind of emergence and him having his career year last year and looking like he's ascending to potential superstar status, I like them kind of the same level. And I love Adam Jones. I got him on a couple of different fantasy teams already this year. But a guy in that Orioles lineup who really showed last year with 32 bombs, he hit .287. Only 82 RBIs, he scored over 100 games, and he played every single game, played 162
wow.
games, 16 steals to throw that in for you. So I think he's an emerging stud, and I like him up there, even with the tremendous Joey Bats. What do you think about
that? Joey Bats, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
So what?
Adam Jones, a guy who we talked about this before, but the Orioles stole him from the Mariners in that Eric Bedard trade. Thanks, Mariners.
Wow. Yeah, I mean that's awesome. That, you know, you put Adam Jones in that same conversation. Joey Bats, like you said, has had a couple of years with sort of outstanding offensive production. Like you said, when you get a guy who can play all, you know, 162, I mean, especially, you know, for the actual teams and help, but I think for fantasy, the guy's putting consistent numbers and you can rely on him, you know, day in and day out to actually play, and that should help an owner as well. So that's an interesting way to look at it, and, you know, I think it sort of marks Adam Jones' ascent to the sort of national framework in that top tier of outfielders. So that's I like that analogy. That's a good spell.
Well, thank you. And I think it goes without saying, I think you would agree that Granderson would be up there too if he wasn't guaranteed to be missing that time. So kind of the question with him, though, is then if you're in a snake draft, where do you take him? Because it depends on whether you're doing rotisserie or head-to-head. He's more valuable in head-to-head, missing that much time, because as long as you can kind of stay afloat for those 5 weeks, then you get a big boost when he comes back. So it's interesting, you know, how early do you take Granderson?
The experience that I have in our league, I mean, he was a keeper. I think, you know, someone picked him 2 years ago in something like the 10th round. So obviously that value is definitely not going to be there. But I think for somewhere around maybe 5th or 6th round.
Yeah.
Is that too high?
I don't know. I don't think that's too high. I mean, I might pick him in the 4th if he was there. I don't know. It depends on how much confidence you have in your team. You know, and
yeah, and also like you said, if it's head to head, I think you can go ahead and bite the bullet. You know, some of those early weeks, and just, you know, and expect that boost, that pickup. You know, once he comes back off injury, but like you said, rotisserie, you got to make that decision. I think, like you said. You know, his value drops, and you know, he drops a little bit in draft.
Yeah.
If you're looking at a rotisserie style league.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And the other thing is, we're saying that it's easier to come back, but who knows? This injury could, you know, he could come back at the beginning of May, but then he's not himself for a month. So
that's true. Yeah, work out those kinks.
Definitely risk, but it's not like it's an ACL or something where he's not going to be able to play center field. It's just getting the bone healed and then kind of building himself back up once he's physically able to do all the demands of the position, swinging a bat, throwing a ball, et cetera. I love Grant. He's a great interview. He seems like a really sweet guy. I mean, who knows? Very superficial view of him I've gotten, but he seems like a cool character.
Yeah, definitely, and happy to see his, you know, his success he's had over the past couple of years, especially as a power hitter.
Yeah, definitely. Let's talk about some speedsters. Let's talk about Desmond Jennings and Jacoby Ellsbury. And Jennings is a guy who has gotten everybody really excited the last few years. Was kind of always the heir apparent to the outfield. You know, once Carl Crawford was gone, and then he, you know, departed for free agency. And put together a pretty good fantasy year last year. The batting average is obviously a question mark. He hit only .246 last year. But Joe Maddon has declared him his opening day leadoff hitter. And he did hit 13 home runs, managed to steal 30 bases, scored 85 runs. So he could just get on base. There's tons of value. He has pop. Just needs to boost that average a little bit. But if he can make any sort of leap in the contact department, resulting in a higher average, he suddenly becomes incredibly valuable. Potential for 15 to 20 home runs, and he should steal 30 bases with ease. More if he can hold on to the leadoff spot. So Jennings is exciting, and Ellsbury, nobody knows. He was an MVP candidate. Another guy that he'll play a lot. And while it's guaranteeing Granderson, it's a bit mark, and he slides to the 6th, 7th round. You know, I think you have to take him. I don't think he'll slide that low. But this is also a guy. These are kind of guys. This is an interesting addition to strategy. And Carson, we've both seen this in baseball drafts, football, and basketball. When you're doing an online draft, you can't get everybody in the same place. You have to do an online draft. And somebody's not there, and they have their damn team on auto-pick. This is what happens. You end up with all these interests. They're going to be by Yahoo. And they're going to get auto-picked. change their when they saw it was in. And it can have an effect because that team can end up being good if all those guys bounce.
Yeah, you know, that's definitely true. And, you know, especially you sort of hate when a guy has auto pick, is picking ahead of you and you have someone in mind, you have your eye on, and they snag it. But definitely true also, like you said, with injured guys that get picked up, you might think, hey, that's a stupid pick. You know, it is at the time, but it is panning out, I guess, at least somewhat during the season when those guys come back off of injury.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Well, we've talked about baseball enough. Let's get to football. And Carson last gave us three of his top guys to keep an eye on at the combine, guys that he thought were going to bust out and have a very positive impact on their draft status by their performance. One of those guys was Tavon Austin. Am I correct?
Yeah, Tavon Austin. And you know, starting off with him, you know, he ended up running, I guess, officially tied for the second fastest 40, I guess, which we sort of all expected, you know, at a 4.34. And, you know, his bench press was respectable. He had double digits on the 225 reps, which I guess, if anything, a receiver doesn't need to bench the entire world. But, you know, let you know, he definitely put some time and effort in preparing for the combine. And then, you know, in the position drill, I think he did okay. I think he did pretty well. Just sort of catching balls and doing that, but he's definitely a guy that folks have their eye on coming into the combine, and it was sort of good to see him move around. I got to talk about Ace Sanders. I know Ace, I kept my eye on him a little bit. He made some pretty spectacular catches, just sort of in the position of drills. I thought that was pretty interesting to note as well. A guy that, you know, Mike Mayock thought that he came out a little too early, you know, had more work to do at South Carolina, but regardless, he gave him respect for the effort he's putting in the plays he's making, you know, at least just on the practice field.
Yeah, for sure. And Tavon Austin had the second highest 20-yard shuttle time of any receiver, so that bodes well for a possible slot threat, does it not?
No, yeah, it definitely does. And you know, I was revealed to me at least at the combine that, you know, when he first came to West Virginia, he you know, played running back. So, like we talked about before, he's one of those versatile guys that you take and play the flank, can play the slot, can play in the backfield, can line up, you know, any number of positions, you know, plays on the field. So I think, you know, his value is definitely there. And like I said, the pro day, I think, you know, it should be interesting to see him work out with Gino. And, you know, I think his stock can only go up from there. But I think based on his performance in the combine, I think it was about what we expected. Wasn't anything too crazy, but you know, definitely, you know, look for him to turn some heads at the pro day and make an impact on draft day.
Okay, so what about I think Barkevious Mingo was one of your other people to keep an eye on. How did he do at the combine, and how did that maybe improve or hurt his stock?
So with Mingo's situation, I know we talked about, you know, last time we met about sort of his sort of tweener status. He played defensive end in college, but obviously, you know, he's 240 pounds. He'll have to make the transition to outside linebacker. And I think he did pretty well in position drills. I saw him. I saw his workout, and he looked, you know, pretty fluid, you know, on 2 feet, you know, without his hand in the dirt. And his 40 time, he ran, I want to say, in the 4.6, 4.5 range. So the speed was there, you know, about what we expected, you know, for a guy that's going to have to play outside linebacker in the next level. But just a raw guy, like we talked about before, and it was good to see him, you know, moving around to the bag drills, you know, with, you know, coming out of a 2-point stance. I thought he did pretty well in that. It was pretty fluid. Would have liked to see him put on maybe a little bit more weight. He came at 240. You know, he didn't look like the biggest guy, especially next to all the other defensive line prospects, linebacker prospects. But he definitely, you know, did what was expected. He ran a great time in the 40, and did some good things in the position drills.
Okay. Now I want to ask you about Mingo because the tweener status is interesting, and obviously in the NFL, I mean, the defensive schemes can alter players' value so much, you know, from team to team. Like a given guy might be a very important one defense where another coordinator almost couldn't use him. So is Mingo kind of a boom or bust prospect? Like, does he have a chance to really flop if he can't stick it at linebacker, or is he a guy who you think is talented enough that he'll be able to kind of figure it out, even if he doesn't kind of adapt to the position the way people hope he might?
Well, I mean, you make a good point when you talk about sort of boom or bust and the guys that are sort of relegated to playing in one type of system, and you're absolutely right about that. And Mingo's situation, we look in the past, we look at guys like DeMarcus Ware, you look at guys like Sean Merriman before he got injured. Sean Merriman played defensive end in college, and, you know, as DeMarcus Ware, those guys made the transition to outside linebacker, but in a 3-4 system. In the 3-4 system, you know, the outside linebacker is essentially another down lineman. You know, 3-4 originates from the 5-3 scheme, but they have guys that, you know, are made to rush the edge. Now, if we get Barkevius Mingo this year and we say, hey, you know, we need you to replace Steven Nicholas, you know, play outside linebacker, it's not going to be pretty. I don't think he has the sort of the innate abilities to play a position in a 4-3 system, a traditional system like we run in Atlanta. What he's going to have to do is play on that edge in the 3-4, because those guys are, I'd say, half their job to, you know, maybe 75% of their job is to rush that edge, to be that fourth defender coming down. So it's going to be an easier transition if he gets, you know, selected by a 3-4 team. I think that's the only way he's going to go. It is in a 3-4 system. So I think that's going to help, you know, play his abilities. You know, when you're used to playing defensive end, you know, you rush the pass, that's what you do. But, you know, when you get in a 3-4 system, they sort of make ways for you to rush that edge. You do some stuff in coverage, but, you know, you're coming, you know, half the time. So I think that's going to be good fit for him in a 3-4 system. Like I said, a 4-3 just really wouldn't be the great fit for him right now.
So is he a player who one John Gruden might refer to as a joker?
I think he's a classic example of a Gruden joker, because, you know, like you said, he's gonna be asked to do a lot of things. He's gonna be asked to cover. He's gonna be asked to, you know, set the edge, running plays, rush the passer. So I think you could classify him as a Gruden joker.
Yeah. I mean, I just, like, have heard so much about this guy, Mingo. I'm excited to see where he goes. I'm not going on the recent success of Von Miller and before him Clay Matthews, but it seems like the nature of the position and what you're saying, in that a lot of the time they can just kind of pin their ears back and focus on rushing the passer, it's a position that makes it, let's just say, it gives you the capability to have a lot of success in your rookie year. Because, you know, you can kind of get by with explosiveness and athleticism, and obviously you'll only get better as you, you know, become more savvy and veteran. But, you know, it's a position where I think he could have a real big impact even as a rookie next year.
Definitely. I mean, like I said, in the right system, which I think is going to be a 3-4, he can definitely, like you said, get on the field and make an impact in his first year. So definitely excited to see, you know, where he goes in the draft and look for him to fill in that 3-4 outside linebacker role.
Nice. Well said. So I believe the last guy was the Kraut, was it not?
Bjorn Warner?
It was. It was Bjorn Warner. And, he had a decent combine, and when you look at it, we talked about Asa. I think I listed him at 250, so I would like to see him get a little bigger. He showed up at the combine at 266, which is helpful. I ran a sub-5. He ran a 4.88 40, which I think is pretty good. And when you look at a guy like Mingo, we talked about who played defensive end in college, you know, he's going to be a guy moving, you know, making transition to the outside linebacker position. Bjorn Warner is a true defensive end. Like I said, just by his size, he's 266, runs a 4.8 at the 40. And I think that, you know, I watched him in a couple of drills, and I think he looked pretty good. And I went back and I looked at some of his tape from this past year, and I think the biggest thing that I'm concerned about with him is and making the transition is leverage. And the fact that when you look at a lot of his stuff in college, you know, he sort of stands straight up and he can manhandle people and he can, you know, come off the ball with pretty good explosiveness. I'm going to use his hands, but I think he stays up too much in terms of his stature. And the drills is sort of the same thing, you know, standing straight up, doing a lot of the drills that sort of require you to sort of bend at the waist and get low. And I think that's going to be really important for him making the transition to the NFL, where guys are a lot stronger, a lot more athletic. He's going to be able to – he's going to have to learn how to use leverage to his advantage, you know, not only using his hands and his explosiveness off the ball, but being able to use that leverage to explode up and get under guys and use leverage to move people. But, you know, that can be taught. But, you know, based on, you know, what I saw, you know, I liked the weight gain as a plus. I think he ran, you know, probably about what I expect, maybe a little bit better. And in the drills, he did okay. Wasn't blown away by his, you know, performance in the drills, but you know, he did okay, like I said.
Yeah, and every coach likes a moldable guy that they can – get their hands on and turn into their guy. And speaking of coaches, it sounds like Bjorn Werner could do with a little coaching from old Coach Thomas, as he always said, Benja Ben. Benja Ben. So get over there and give Werner some one-on-one. I think you will only benefit, only stand to improve as a person, as a player, and as a humanitarian, let's say.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I was saying German, but, you know, I guess the humanitarian also makes sense.
Also, as a Jew, yeah. Coach Tom would be more practical than not American. Okay, and so we covered the guys that you kind of last week talked about having your eye on and being excited about. Were there any people that you happened to catch or even that you saw just their numbers after the fact and you were – pretty surprised or just remarked upon their performance?
A couple guys wanted to mention Ryan Swope. He's a guy out of Texas A&M who actually tied Austin for the second fastest 40 official. You know, a guy that wasn't really expected to run that fast. He had some injury issues this past season. You know, only played in a couple of games, but you know, we look at him on tape. He's, you know, productive when he got the chance. You know, good hands guy, but no one expected him to run a 4.3. I think that's going to help his stock a lot, especially coming off of injury. You know, a guy that doesn't have too much tape from his senior year, and you look at that number, it's, you know, 4.3. I think you expect him to be able to stretch the field a little bit on offense, and, you know, if not, contribute on special teams. So I think he's a guy that did a lot for his stock. And another thing I want to talk about, too, was, you know, the Honey Badger Town, Matthew, everyone would want to pronounce it. You know, he came into the combine, so, you know, after not playing this past season, he ran a 4.5, you know, didn't do great work on the bench press. I think he might have got, like, four reps or something on the 225 bench press, which sort of raised some concerns about his effort and his willingness to work. But, you know, Deion Sanders was adamant about this guy. He said he went and saw him a couple weeks ago down in Florida training, and he said, you know, that this guy is going to be a baller. He said he's going to be, you know, an impact player from his first year, and look for him to have impact on a team's defense that's in every down corner, which, you know, which goes against pretty much what I thought watching him in college, and pretty much any other analyst that, you know, watched college football and opines about people's prospects of playing in the league, is that he was just too physically too small to play that, and that he would be in special nickel packages and on special teams. But Deion Sanders, this guy's in every down corner who will make an immediate impact on a team. Coming from Deion, I think that's pretty huge. But, you know, like you said, I think, you know, one thing is the size, another thing is the off-the-field issues that you have to take a look at if you're a GM, you know, trying to make that pick to see where he'll go. But like you said, you know, like I said, his stock will only go up from here. Especially with the pro day and does well in interviews, I think.
So, I'm just like a little confused. I mean, do you think, like, everybody must hold Deion's opinion in very high esteem, and rightly so, especially about you know, a fellow secondary player. I mean, he's the king of the secondary, but I don't know. Does he have some connection to the kid that he's just trying to help him out, or?
There's the one thing that he talked about when I was a physical, and he said he saw him work out, and he said that, you know, firsthand, you know, he was very impressive, and he thinks that he can be an impact player, be a baller in the league, as he says. But the other thing was, he said he talked to him, and I think a lot what Deion had to say was just sort of taking that face value. He said that, you know, the way he talked to Deion about, you know, not being a follower anymore and being a leader, I think Deion sort of took at face value, and if he's being too trustworthy of his words, you know, after he's had all his problems in college, you know, possibly, you know, that could be, you know, one thing that sort of played into Deion's sort of opinion of him, was just purely based on what Tom Matthew told him, that, you know, he'd stop smoking, that he was going to, you know, get things together and sort of get better to be able to play in the league, and how he turned over a new leaf. But, I mean, that remains to be seen if, you know, that's actually going to happen, and, you know, if he's actually going to commit to playing football and avoiding things that could hurt his career. But physically, Deion said he was definitely, you know, all what he expected and more. And, you know, I guess as a person, Deion really felt that he made some strides.
Yeah. Well, that's good. And, you know, if he could use the same skills that he used to win over Deion in that interview process. And like you said, the interviews are very important. And, you know, guys have, you know, off-the-field problems is such a catch-all statement, and it's thrown around a lot. But I think, you know, if you're looking for a guy for your NFL team, your reason, I mean, human beings aren't perfect. You're looking for a guy, you know, that can take accountability. And I think even though he went through this, if he's a guy who kind of can show that he learned from it and that, you know, he's grown up a bit, I think that can go a long way toward having a good, you know, impression on a GM or an owner or a coach or whomever, and having that, you know, translate into high draft pick. You know, I think there's a lot of, through the scouting process, there's a lot of kind of that's my guy type feelings from coaches and from personnel guys where, you know, through just meeting a guy much more than seeing film, or, you know, even seeing them live at the combine, through meeting them and talking to them, kind of become enamored. And, you know, maybe he is a guy who, I don't know. I mean, he clearly had some problems with the law and with focusing on football, but, maybe he learned from it. And so, yeah, I would like, how high do you think he could go? Do you think he would be like a fourth round?
I mean, I sort of think that his sort of money round would be the third round right now. I don't see, I mean, maybe late second, a team that has a lot of picks, maybe you could throw one at him, you know, just to sort of cushion it. And I think as workout two and his pro day, you know, you'll sort of see more of what he has to offer. Like, so the interview process is important, but I mean, I think third round would probably be the highest I'd see him going. Like you said, I mean, Deion gives him his mark of approval, but, you know, just based on the stature and the size, I mean, it's going to be tough to draft a guy that you're going to have, you know, into, like, packages playing nickel, you know, in the first two rounds. So I think a third round is where teams might be able to grab him and sort of take a chance and see what he has to offer.
Okay. Well, great reporting. Let's just cover a few quick minutes of the NFL, not just the guys who will soon be joining the NFL, before we sign off tonight. And let's talk about the news of the day, or maybe it was yesterday, but Alex Smith, while the trade can't be official until March 12th, it sounds like Alex Smith is City Chief. He'll play for Andy Reid and that very disappointing Chiefs team, but a team with some talent. How do you like this move, first of all, for the Chiefs, Carson? And then, let's start with the Chiefs. How do you like this for the Chiefs?
I think the move wasn't, wasn't too surprising. I think when I saw the headline that Alex Smith, you know, likely to be traded, you know, the Chiefs was the first thing that came to mind, just based on the, you know, sort of lack of production in the quarterback position over the past couple of years. But, I don't really know what to think about the position right now. So I think Andy Reid, he is known as being an offensive guru and sort of mentoring quarterbacks. Alex Smith had some success, you know, the past couple of years, and you know, had a great season last year until he got injured and Colin Kaepernick took over. But I just think that, you know, I think Andy Reid at times makes quarterbacks do too much, and I think it's going to be, you know, sort of interesting to see, you know, to say the least, how sort of Andy Reid has him in that offense and sort of what he expects from Alex Smith in that offense, because you know he's sort of known to expect a lot of his quarterbacks and sort of open up the playbook and throw the ball a lot, and I don't think Alex Smith is that type of quarterback necessarily. So I think that's going to be something interesting to look at, you know, as he joins the team and sort of what his role is going to be. But I think for offseason in the draft, I think, you know, you have to shore up the defense and then do your best to get as many weapons, you know, around him, Dwayne Bowe and Jamal Charles. So, you know, I think it's a good move for the Chiefs on paper, but we'll have to see how that turns out.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the reason it makes sense to me is just the kind of lack of any really exciting quarterback prospects this year, combined with not a ton of guys in free agency either. And, you know, the Chiefs kind of already having decided that they were going to go after a different position with that number one overall pick, or, you know, I guess they could trade down potentially. But, I mean, to me, if you're taking over this team, even if you're quarterback guru Andy Reid, I mean, looking at the film and watching their game, Jamal Charles is your man. And if you're going to win, it's going to be on the strength of Jamal Charles. I mean, the dude is an animal. And, you know, find a way to use him right. You know, right on the show, Carson, you praised Leslie Frazier, and you were saying, look, this isn't a backhanded compliment. He knew he had the best running back in the league with Adrian Peterson, and he found a way to ride him. He found a way to get him the ball, and he centered everything around him. Jamal Charles isn't quite Adrian Peterson, but he's not far behind him. And to me, if the Chiefs are going to win, I know it's a pass-first league, but you got to get Jamal Charles the ball as much as possible. So from that standpoint, I kind of like the Smith to them. I mean, they're not expecting to compete for the Super Bowl title, you know, so you bring on kind of a safe quarterback, and they're just hoping to win a few more games this year, I should think, and make their fans at least a little bit optimistic for the future. But who do you see them bringing in as other weapons, maybe a receiver, tight end, other offensive weapon to help out Mr. Smith?
I mean, you know, when you sort of look at that number one pick, I mean, obviously, I think that is either going to be dedicated to an offensive lineman, you know, or it can be traded down. I saw a couple of mock drafts that had Star with Budalelli going. He, you know, just got revealed that he has a heart condition that, you know, doesn't look too great for him right now. But I mean, you said the wide receiver position doesn't look bad. You know, a tight end, you know, maybe second round. You know, Tyler Eifert is a guy that sort of stood out at the combine. A big guy, you know, 6'5". I mean, he ended up jumping like a 35-inch vertical. I think he could be a nice weapon to have, especially, you know, after losing Tony Gonzalez, I guess, years ago. That'd be nice to have a guy sort of in the middle that can open the field up. And then also, there's a guy named Escobar out of San Diego State who, you know, has some decent numbers, but he's also a big guy, 6'5", who a lot of guys are really big on, you know, in the way that he catches the ball. You know, great hands, big target. So it's going to be interesting to see how they go and sort of the things that they need to shore up because the defense still has a lot of problems. But when you bring in a quarterback and you're expecting production out of offense, I think Dwayne Bowe, he's sort of been wasting away. You know, he's been productive, but he could be a lot more productive if he had a guy that was capable of throwing to him. So it'll be interesting to see where they go. I think, you know, look for them, you know, mid-round to get some guys on offense that, you know, might be able to be steals from the draft.
Okay. Well said. I have to say to everybody who's still with us so much, and I just want to point out and give myself a little bit of credit, if you don't mind. I've been very focused on this show and focus on talking about baseball and football. And all this time, there's been a basketball game going on in the same room. And while I've looked over a few times, I really haven't looked over that much. And Steph Curry has 54 points right now.
Wow.
He's 7 of 13 from 3. 18 of 28 overall. He's got 54, 5 boards, and 7 assists, and 3 steals.
Gee.
11 for 13. That's got to be up there as one of the best three-point performances of all time. I mean, I don't know. How many? I don't know what the personal record is. I'm sure they'll start talking about it at the end of this game. But it's now the Knicks are now up 4 with 45 seconds left. So this, unless the Warriors can really and they got the ball back. How did they get a steal? Oh, they just stole it off the inbound too. Wow, the Warriors are gonna looks like they're gonna waste a 54 point night from Steph Curry unless they can really a miracle comeback. Wow. Huh.
That's tough.
So turn on SportsCenter after the show, ladies and gentlemen, because you're going to see. Oh, there you go. Franchise record 11 three-pointers. Most points in the NBA this season. Wow. But Tyson Chandler had 10 offensive rebounds for the Knicks, so that made the difference. Well, I guess I'm about tapped out of sports knowledge. I mean, we could always talk about more things, but maybe good people of America go to sleep at this advanced hour. Oh, my God. The Warriors are blowing it. They just lost. That's so disappointing. Thanks for joining me, Clay.
Thanks for having me. I think, you know, sorry I had to get the late start, but, you know, wanted to let people know about the combine and what to look for, you know, as we move towards that third weekend in April. So,
yeah. I mean, that's the NFL. That's the next thing on the NFL docket to get excited about, because free agency isn't usually that wild. There's a few names that kind of shift locations, but, you know, I guess cutting is almost more shocking than the free agent signings themselves. So we will continue to kind of talk about the NFL draft as it gets closer, but next week we'll continue with our fantasy baseball preview, moving over to one of the central divisions. Maybe we'll do both the central divisions in one show because they're such powerhouses that they have to go together.
Hey, why not?
We might do that. We might get some March Madness discussion going too as we draw closer to the tournament. We can
there it is.
And bring in some guests to talk to us about bracketology.
Surreal science, yeah.
So again, this has been Foul Territory on Blog Talk Radio, sponsored by BackSportsPage.com and Gatorade. Yeah, that just happened. Buick doesn't want us, though. Buick needs someone a little more mature, but we don't need to, frankly. Anyway, thanks for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been real. Do we have an ending song?
What you got?
Soulja Boy, tough. Hey, I got the new dance for y'all called the Soulja Boy.
It's gotta be Soulja Boy, send them off.
You gotta punch, then crank back 3 times from left to right. You know why I'm in there, ho. Why me crank it, why me roll?